This video is brought to you by Holocasa. Our tool transforms independent local real estate agents to global real estate agents. Create your own profile for free and get contacted by international investors. Sign up with the link in the description. Hello and welcome everyone to our 107th session of Holocasa. My name is Michael and today I'm talking to Lane Kawaoka from Hawaii. Lane is an ex-engineer and now owns over 10,000 rental units, which accumulate to $2.1 billion US in value. He shares the simple methods and tactical steps to build passive real estate portfolios on the side while having a day job. Lane is also a writer for Forbes Top 50 Investing Podcast and published an Amazon best-selling book. Lane, I'm very proud and honored to be here with you and to have you on the show. Why don't you introduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah, thanks for having me and aloha everybody from Hawaii here. But yeah, cool to see everybody from kind of all over the world, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah. You have built so much of wealth as a side. As someone who is totally new to that game, first of all, how did everything start? How did you come up with this idea?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of stumbled into this. You know, I kind of grew up, you know, in a pretty frugal family where, you know, you're taught to study hard and save your money. And I call this a linear path, in fact, where, you know, you go to school. I, you know, became an engineer and I just started to work at a, you know, professional job and, you know, still on this linear path of buying a house to live in, which I don't necessarily think is a good idea for, you know, younger people who are starting out on their financial journeys. But, you know, we don't know any better, right? And then a lot of our parents and colleagues are kind of doing the traditional wealth building dogma that's out there. So I, you know, saved up my money, you know, took me a few years out of college to save up for a down payment on my first, not rental at the time, but just a place to live in. But, you know, that was in my early 20s. And because I was traveling all over for work as a construction supervisor, I realized, you know, what a waste it was that I was only home to enjoy that nice house to myself one day a week. So, you know, this is back in 2009, 2010, and I started to rent it out. And that was the first one. And that was where I got this taste of cash flow. And I realized, wow, if I just do this a, you know, handful of more times, I'll be definitely on the path to financial freedom. And at the very least, I won't have to work at this crummy engineering job forever.
Sounds amazing. For someone who's not familiar with that game, maybe you can walk us through or give us a quick overview. What is the difference between buying for rental income and buying for, let's say, the hope that the price goes up? Where's the intersection there and where's the difference?
Yeah, I guess the intersection is, you know, you're buying a property and, you know, you own it and the price goes up. We call that appreciation. So the difference is no difference there, right? So let's just old school algebra. We negate that those two factors. The big things are tax benefits, right? When you are a landlord or a rental property owner or a LP syndication investor, you get these great tax benefits from owning these rental properties that go well beyond, you know, sure, as a homeowner, you're able to deduct the interest expenses that you have. But that's pretty much, that's not really a good reason why to do it, right? That's just what the lending brokers tell you to do to kind of justify the expense. You're also getting that as a landlord too on rental properties. So that's negated. But when you're strictly, you know, having properties that you rent out to other people, you're able to take a depreciation on the asset, which, you know, in terms of tax code, basically means you're able to take a negative paper loss on that asset. Here in America, 27 years, but when you get into larger assets and syndications and apartments, you know, we are able to do, you know, pretty nifty things with cost segregation and bonus depreciation to aggressively write it off a lot quicker. But again, from a high level, right, the better tax benefits. And the other thing, you know, you have cash flow, right? Income minus expenses. The tenant pays me rent, I pay. Few things break, you know, you put some money aside for CapEx, you pay for insurance, you pay for your mortgage, you have this excess of cash at the end of the month. And for me, really, when I was starting out, I was like, wow, this is cool, right? Like, you know, as a young 20-something-year-old kid, that was a lot of beer money rolling in every month. You know, it wasn't amazing, right? It wasn't something to quit my job over, but it was, you know, one of the few ways you're making money, multiple ways you're making money with this rental, and that's cash flow. I think the big difference between owning your own house versus you renting your property out is, you know, you're paying the mortgage both ways, right? The difference is you're paying down your mortgage when you live in it. So you're putting in heart, sweat, and tears to build up that, pay down the mortgage, gain equity slowly over time. Whereas when you're the landlord or rental property owner, your tenant's doing that. They're the one putting it. And I think that's, you know, that's the third thing that is a big difference between owning your house. And this is why, you know, you've heard it from, you know, maybe controversial, but people say that your house is not an asset. It is, kind of, but there are, essentially, way I look at it, there are other ways you can grow your money faster and safer too. And one of those is rental real estate, and especially when you get into value add rental real estate.
So you're basically more focused on investing into a farm with cows which already give milk than a farm which doesn't have cows yet.
Yeah, I guess so, right? Or the goose that lays the golden eggs, you know, it's all the same proverbs and stories, right? Yeah.
And then you can, obviously, you can, tax-wise, you can just put off all the costs, all the expenses you have, and break even, and then basically you are fine. So it's always like a numbers game in terms of, okay, how much more do I want to be cash flow positive, and how much do I want to have the expenses in order to make sure that I actually am perfectly off regarding my tax return. Is that basically the idea?
Exactly, right? Like, a lot of times that those paper losses are in excess of what you're making. Therefore, you don't pay any taxes on it. But, you know, that's cool and all. But, you know, when I became more of an accredited investor, started to invest in syndications, private placements, and started to aggressively write off properties, that's when we started to play with plutonium there. And there are some strategies there to not only offset the rental income from that particular asset or other assets you have in your passive investing portfolio, but also offset your ordinary income from your day job. So now, boom, that's when you're really starting to cooking with fire, right?
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I guess a good example would be, you know, like, I think at the very least, right, like, you understand when you have a rental property, you're taking the depreciation losses, the paper losses, and you're using that to offset any cash flow or income you're making out of it. Especially when you're doing cost segregations, getting extra bonus depreciation, or aggressively writing off the asset, you know, perfectly legal within tax code, you're getting a lot of excess losses that may build up. We call this passive activity losses, PALS for short. No, your pals, they're your friends, essentially. So, you know, a good example would be, you know, a high paid doctor getting paid $500,000 a year, right? They're getting killed in taxes. I'm assuming that most countries somewhat have the same progressive tax system where they sort of hit the wealth, the so-called rich or wealthy or higher income earners the most. So the way that, you know, strategically you can use some of these losses to possibly lower your income in this respect and therefore pay less taxes.
Got it. Perfect. So you're bundling both entities, your personal one with the rental income via, let's say, a personal holding, sort of.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it all flows to you personally at the end of the day.
Yeah. Got it. Yeah. How, from one a rental unit you started with, how then exploded everything? How did you create this increasingly impressive profile of rental income units?
Yeah, I mean, that was back in like 2009, bought my first one. And then, you know, I was working my engineering job, maybe getting paid low six figures, barely. But I was able to save a majority of my income because I wasn't living anywhere, right? I was just living off the company dime wherever they put me in the hotel. I did that for several years, actually. So all that money went to buying more and more properties. Bought another couple of units in Seattle where I lived. And then I caught on to this idea of rent to value ratio, which it allows you to kind of compare different investments. So for example, nowadays we kind of look for stuff that will be cash flow positive, and kind of to do that, we look for this rent to value ratio being 1% or higher. So the rent to value ratio is simple math. You just take the monthly rent divided by the purchase price, and again, looking for something 1% or higher. So in Seattle, Washington, or like California, New York, a lot of these higher price primary markets is what we call it, the rent to value ratios just aren't going to work there. You're looking at maybe a $400,000 house that will barely rent for $2,000 a month. So if you do the math, $3,000 a month divided by 400 grand, that's 0.5%. Not going to work. So, this is maybe around 2012. Prices were getting a little bit more expensive at where I was at. So, I kind of caught wind of, investors investing in these, less sexy markets like Birmingham, Atlanta, Indianapolis, Kansas City. Now, these are more secondary type of markets. Maybe not the coolest places to live or visit, but they have better rent to value ratios. And at the end of the day, unless you're gambling on appreciation, we play it more as a cash flow game, right? I think it's a little bit more of a prudent strategy. So I started buying rental properties in more of these secondary markets from 2012 to 2015. And in 2015, I had about 11 of these rental properties in my portfolio. Still working a day job, right, as an engineer. But that was kind of the point. That was kind of how things just kind of snowballed a bit from there.
Makes total sense. And you just mentioned basically that you're not at all, I assume, interested in the fancy dancy mansions, which look nice, but in the end probably cost a lot of money. You're really into the numbers game. And if there's something and it doesn't look appealing, you wouldn't live there yourself, but it has a good rent to value ratio. It's for you like an investment vehicle. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's more of a numbers game, at least in the start, right? I mean, if people want to come back to the website and download our free analyzer, you can just chug the numbers yourself. And the rent to value ratio is a great way to get started, doing your due diligence. Of course, then you want to throw it into the analyzer and kind of go through all the income and the expenses. But for the most part, you have we talked about primary, secondary, and tertiary markets or even smaller markets that we try to stay away from. They're typically maybe 200, quarter million population or less towns. They just don't really have good, robust economies or a diverse employment group there, which you feel is a little bit more riskier. But even within, you take a market like Houston, Texas, for example, great market. You have different classes of assets and neighborhoods too. But in terms of assets, you have your class A stuff, which is your luxury things. You probably live in one of these places, right? Cool, hip place. And then the next level, you may have something maybe at 20, 30 years older, maybe built 1970s, 1980s. This is more your B class asset. And then your class C asset might be like built 1950s, right? Typically, like you mentioned earlier, that the luxury stuff, it isn't going to have the rent to value ratios needed. And also the lower end stuff, it's going to have a harder clientele, right? There's a bit of a sweet spot to this, right? Somewhere in that B class asset. We like to work in this kind of range, and it's kind of known as the industry as workforce housing, housing for the lower middle class workforce, right? Your blue collar workers. I mean, here in America, and probably the same thing going around across the world, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, and the shrinking middle class are, kind of becoming the lower middle class. Sad to say, it is what it is, right? As an investor, you want to kind of understand where the trends are going and position yourself the right way. So we see the workforce housing sector as not only from a philanthropic kind of viewpoint, a place that needs investment and really needs more supply, but it is a growing demand for that. Especially here in America, we have a lot of immigrants coming in as opposed to, I think, other foreign countries. Again, when you come into America, you're unless you're going the EB40 route, you're typically coming in at the lower middle class, right?
I was about to ask you about like rent to own ratio in the US. It is still like a huge share of people having to rent and not owning. So that's why like your market is also for yourself, like working or appealing, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where the numbers are, but you know, it kind of goes back and forth from like 60%, 40%.
Yeah, makes total sense.
But you know, I mean, that's how we got to this, maybe this world crisis, right? George Bush in America had the great idea that everybody should own their own property. So thus ensued this ridiculous underwriting standards for loans. And that's kind of what created all these people who shouldn't have, you know, properties and loans. You know, they got them, and that's ensued that bubble bursting, right? But I would say post 2008, the trend has been kind of going back the other way. And it'll sure as go back and forth, right? But I think other trends for sure, like, you know, people, they want nicer things, newer things. This is why we kind of are now into development of workforce housing. It's stuff I lived, nicer stuff I lived in college, that's for sure. But, you know, it's nice properties. It's, you know, I wouldn't call it luxury though, but it's what I think a lot of lower middle class to middle class people want these days. It's something mm-hmm. newer, and you know, something that they can still call home, be proud of.
So basically you take like a couple of different data points into account when evaluating a good investment. You go for primary, secondary, tertiary market, class A, class B, class C, and then you basically take a matrix and say, and then potentially also identify where potential renters are interested in, as you just mentioned. Is there another data point which is interesting for you, which you think, okay, this definitely has to be part of the equation?
I mean, this is, I think, why we invest in real estate, because it doesn't take a genius to mm-hmm. invest and hit the side of the cow, right? Especially when you're investing with the long-term fundamentals of, you know, population is increasing, especially on the lower end side. You know, we look for housing that kind of caters to that big demographic, you know? And, you know, I think that at the end of the day, we kind of let the numbers speak for themselves and, you know, look at it from an asset point of view of like, you know, what is the income produced based on the, you know, what is the risk and the debt service coverage ratio.
You just mentioned a very good keyword regarding risk. It sounds risky to me if you have like so many assets, and then I always think for myself, okay, how much is still is 1% owned? How much is it going with the mortgage rates, with also obviously the increasing interest rate? Making basically like trying to optimize everything, I assume you definitely use the leverage of financing to a certain degree. First question is, how do you normally manage that? And is now a situation with the increasing interest rate a huge risk to your model, or how can I imagine that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, kind of two things there, right? Like if the bank doesn't deem that we have a good business plan, they don't give us a loan, right? So mm-hmm. typically they're looking at our underwriting from a debt service coverage ratio. In America, typically like 1.2, 1.3 debt service ratio, meaning that your net operating income at the end of the month is going to be maybe 20% higher than your debt service, is kind of what they're looking for to give you that loan. So, you know, normally we go into deals, you know, hitting those numbers so we can comfortably play that debt service. Secondly, you know, we're playing a different game these days than I did when I was kind of just, you know, working my day job. And back then I was doing the buy, hope, and pray model, right? And I think most investors do it this way, right? They get a loan, they buy a top property. They know they're going to get cash flow, right? Because, you know, they can underwrite it, but they kind of pray that the value goes up. And it typically does, right? What we do is value add. So when we go into an asset, we have a rather large CapEx plan to, you know, we do apartments, right? We'll typically buy 200, 400 unit apartments, and we'll go in as tenants naturally leave and, you know, move elsewhere. We'll fix up the flooring, the new appliances, new paint job. And then we'll do some exterior improvements like the clubhouse, playground equipment, et cetera. But, you know, we're not doing a huge, huge facelift, right? But we're doing enough to be able to bump the rents up maybe $100, a couple hundred bucks across the board, mm-hmm. thus increasing the income. And we're also doing other management value add projects, you know, running it a lower or staying a nice level of expenses. At the end of the day, we're just want to increase the net operating income. And for business owners out there, you guys know this as EBITDA, right? Properties are sold based on net operating incomes divided by what the prevailing cap rates are. And that's how we create value. And that's how we create that. This is how we kind of overcome risks, right? We overcome risks by just making a whole bunch of value in the process. You know, they say something I've heard a while back ago that really gives me a lot of confidence in this is, you know, there's a lot of traders out there that buy low, sell high. When you do that, you really have to time the market and you really have to like make sure you buy right. But, you know, wealth comes to those who create value. That's what we're doing, right? We're going in there doing physical construction. Tenants pay more for that, and we're rewarded that by higher property values in the end. So that's kind of a way, I mean, it's not overnight, right? A lot of our projects can take a year, a couple years to get anywhere near where we want it to be. But over time, we're moving in the right direction. And as far as appreciation, I know you guys talk about appreciation. There are two kinds of appreciation. There is market appreciation, which goes up and down, somewhat cyclical, but it generally goes up, right? Which I think is why we all like real estate in general. But the other one is forced appreciation. And that's kind of what we're talking about here, right? Taking fate in your own hands and wielding value into your asset in that respect. So that's kind of the way we, you know, we kind of hedge risk in a way, right? We make it a better asset, you know? As far as right now, right, some of the value add projects we've kind of put in hold as of last summer, as of interest rates have started to creep up. And we've kind of switched our methods a little bit to account for that. Instead of, you know, value adding a multi-year project where the interest rate is very contingent on it, these days we're kind of looking more at ground up development, still in the workforce housing sector, or, you know, preferred equity, more on the conservative side. So, you know, we kind of take what the market gives us, right? Right now, doing value add multifamily projects where you're holding it for more than several years, you know, really is difficult, right? With interest, floating interest rates increasing. Hopefully it should kind of end up, you know, end here soon, and maybe we'll get back to that. But at this point, we've kind of pivoted operations of what we do.
How do I go from one rental unit, which I bought, I got a loan, I have a normal job, I don't have, I don't make a lot of money, to basically the second one? Do I just need to make sure and try to that the bank gives me somehow a loan in order to cover it? And maybe also the underlying question there, how should I make sure that I'm not getting defaulted or getting basically into problems when I'm being hit with some regulatory differences, some changes there, some interest rate changes? How much risk exposure should an individual have, do you think, versus being a little bit more conservative?
Well, I think it comes down to what you're buying and your underwriting. You know, if you can put fixed rate debt on there, you've pretty much taken out most of the variables. And at that point, it's just a matter of having enough buffer in your P&Ls or your budget to account for things breaking or fixing, or maybe your tenant skips town and you have to do an eviction. You know, at that point, you need to have also some cash reserves to absorb those catastrophes that will happen down the road.
Do you have a suggestion or a rule there for someone to say, okay, you should definitely have X, Y, Z amount of cash in your bank for a property of that value or for a rental unit of that value, just to make sure that you are safe and you can, in those situations, you can definitely answer with the financial tools.
Yeah, I mean, imagine what is the worst case scenario, right? The perceptive worst case scenario. I mean, for me, I mean, I've had many evictions, and just my track record, one out of three of those ended up in like a $5,000 to $20,000 repair bill because the tenant just trashed the property. So that I would probably call worst case scenario. I mean, hurricane could come and tear down your house, tornado, but that's what you have insurance for, right? To mitigate those catastrophes. But you know, if you say worst case scenario, like that's not covered by any type of, you know, insurance, $20,000, maybe if that, you know, that's, but, you know, at that point, I don't know if it's prudent to have $20,000 in cash reserves, especially if you're starting out, you know, but I'm not giving any financial advice here, right? Like, it depends on how you want to run your budgets and your tolerances. The chances of a $20,000 catastrophe like that happening, it's very, very small. Very small. Well, $5,000 one where maybe somebody steals your HVAC or something like that, it tends to happen quite a bit, right? So maybe the sweet spot is somewhere at $10,000 a month. But, you know, like the people I work with, they typically have, you know, good paying day jobs. They typically save $50,000 to $100,000 a year.
I got it. Okay, perfect.
You
makes
know, like
sense.
You should have the money for that. And I think this is what makes real estate, you know, what's bad about real estate is it's a money intensive game. You need the money to get in. But that's also the good thing, because there is quite a bit of barrier to entry. And this is why, you know, we've gone from single family homes where it's very competitive, everybody and their mother does them. And we've tried to find less competitive places, like buying little 50 unit Class C apartments. Turns out that's a bit of competition too. Then we went stepped up to 200, 300 unit Class Bs. And then this is why we're now developing, right? To constantly move where the grass is a little bit greener over and over again.
Makes total sense.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this isn't, rental properties is not for everybody. If you are uncomfortable with it and you are a credit investor, then maybe you're better off being a passive LP partner. And then you kind of hedge your downside there. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your book and your podcast.
Yeah, so the new book is coming out later this year. It's my third book. It's called The Wealth Elevator. And the premise behind it is, you know, as you ascend a building in this elevator, you have different floors to the building, right? And then just like this wealth building journey, there are different strategies and sage advices that only apply to certain floors. You know, like for example, like the basement, you know, for folks who aren't really good with their money, you may just need to find a better job or, you know, keep a budget, right? Most of our clients come in around the second floor. You know, the first floor would be the stage where your net worth is maybe under $250,000, $500,000. And, you know, you're just starting out. And that's where I was, right, when I was buying little rental properties. But, you know, once you get to that second, third, fourth, and penthouse floors, the game changes, the strategies changes, the mindsets change. And that's what I really want to outline. And quite honestly, there's no book out there that I saw that kind of took a, you know, more from a, you know, from a, each sector or floor broke down each paradigm and the differences and tracked which one you should do certain things and the differences between there. But I mean, that's the book coming up. You know, pretty excited about it. And you know, the podcast today is simplepassivecashflow.com. It's a bit of a follow my journey, you know, learn from my mistakes. When I first started, I was buying rental properties. But nowadays, we're more into syndications and private placements as more private investor investing.
Amazing. Lane, I really learned a lot today from you. I really appreciate the conversation we have been having. You guided us through many things and gave us a very interesting overview on rental prices, rental units, how you started your entire journey regarding your own wealth creation. I really like your approach. I myself, I have read Robert Kiyosaki's books, and I totally agree with you that we should not be as fast to say a rental or a real estate is an asset. So we really have to make sure that it also gives us some money and some cash flow. Is there anything you would like to share with us which we haven't touched upon?
Yeah, I think, I think the one of the issues with people learning about this stuff is not like, I think the first thing you need to do is recognize where you are, right? And that's like the whole concept behind the wealth elevator. First, identifying where you're at and seeking out the strategies for specifically where you are. As you mentioned, there's a lot of books out there that have a lot of, high level esoteric advice, but it applies to different people in different stages of the game. What I wanted to create was more of an actionable set of, wisdom based on where you're at. But yeah, the first part of the game is self-awareness, where you're at. But, I think if people are confused out there, I wouldn't be, I wouldn't feel too bad because the internet, the ethos is filled with just random noise. You should do this, you should do that. But the problem is, what strategies apply to where you are, like specifically when you're between $1 to $2 million net worth, 2.5 to 4.5, and then 5 to 10, and then 10 and beyond, right? Like specifically from certain net worth ranges on the journey, what is it that you need to be doing and what strategies apply and don't apply? And then you also get confused by a lot of, internet marketers, legal promoters selling certain services and stuff like that. Of course, they're all going to say it's for everybody. Yeah. And especially your situation, right? But where are the, the more neutral resources out there that, just is kind of trying to teach each layer to everybody,
I love it. How can people reach out to you?
They can go to simplepassivecashflow.com and then check out the podcast.
Amazing. Lane, thank you so much once again. I really appreciate the exchange, the conversation. It was for me personally as well, like very, very insightful. And I'll leave all your contact information also in the show notes so people can directly reach out to you. And yeah, I'm sending you the best regards to Hawaii.
Cool. All right. See everybody. Bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.